Yeah, so thanks for having me. The talk as it is just a little over half an hour, so feel free to interrupt with questions as they come up. I'd like to start by putting this in a little bit of context, which most of you are probably familiar with, but the task of interpreting quantum theory is largely a metaphysical project, so it aims to find out what is really there underlying the mathematics and phenomenology of quantum mechanics. So really the question is like, what kind of realists do we want to be? There are three categories that people generally define. The first being psiontic interpretations, where the quantum state is an element of the state of reality. So they are realists about the quantum state. An example, the standard example is the de Broglie-Bohm theory, in which you have the wave function supplemented by a position and momentum. So this doesn't say that the quantum state has to be the full description of reality, just that it's directly a part of it. The second class is psi epistemic interpretations, where the quantum state describes knowledge of reality. So epistemic interpretations are anti-realist about the quantum state itself, while being realist about something else, usually some other kind of state. An example would be Rob's toy theory, which is epistemic, but doesn't describe the full quantum theory. And we'll be talking about whether there are any epistemic interpretations actually or not, even though it is a particularly attractive class. The third category is a more recently articulated category, although it, you know, may or may not describe things as old as the Copenhagen interpretation, where the quantum state describes beliefs of agents. The distinction between these two can be a little fuzzy. These generally aren't like exhaustive or perfectly well-defined. So like epistemicists, psi-doxastic interpretations are anti-realist about the quantum state. They can be realist about something else. They cannot be. An example is cubism, which is realist about like Born's rule and some other stuff, but not about any like real state of the universe. So if I can hop on my soapbox for a second, I think that besides this sort of metaphysical project that is generally presented as, interpreting quantum theory can also be this sort of pragmatist pluralist project where we, you know, rather than asking what is really there, we ask, okay, what can we learn about quantum theory via these different interpretations, and how can that help us to produce new and better theories? So foundations folks love to write in our grants that, oh yeah, we're helping towards quantum gravity because we're helping to understand quantum mechanics better. And I think that if we're really gonna do that, the sort of pluralist pragmatist approach is the way to do that. Off the soapbox. So the other main topic of this presentation is state update, by which I mean the fact that quantum states change when you measure them. This is generally a very important feature of quantum mechanics. It's the first thing I learned about in quantum mechanics class with the Stern-Gerlach experiment. It's important in Bell's test, even though it's often presented without reference to state update. And because I work at the IQC, I also have to say it's important for quantum algorithms like error correction. But the prevailing role of state update in interpretations is that a straightforward resolution of the collapse of the wave function, the measurement problem, Schrodinger's cat, and friends is one of the main advantages of psi epistemic interpretations. It's generally discussed in these qualitative terms and not within the ontological model's formalism, which allows us for a quantitative look. And it's almost always discussed with reference to these particular problems. Hence the title, I don't mean literally the measurement problem, just that we're gonna be coming up against these things. And so we'll show that this prevailing view is wrong. Psi epistemic interpretations, at least within the ontological model's formalism, have a much harder time dealing with state update than do psiontic interpretations.
Question. Yeah? Do you have something particular in mind when you say psi epistemic interpretations, like as opposed to psi epistemic research programs that are aiming at an interpretation? Do you like, are you thinking of some particular interpretation that somebody's proposed?
Right, so this meaning like the class of possible, like this is a hypothetic psi epistemic interpretation. So specifically we'll be dealing with the examples that have been proposed so far for psi epistemic interpretations in the ontological model's formalism. So the ABCL model from Aronson et al, LJBR from Lewis et al, and the kitchen sink model, which is for subtheories. But as far as I know, those are the only examples of psi epistemic models within the ontological model's formalism. Yeah. We will have some sort of general statements just for general ontological models that will then apply to those. But the conclusion here comes from those examples. I would have called it a scientist-y theorem if I had a scientist-y theorem. Right, so from here, I would like to review slash maybe introduce to some of you the ontological models formalism, and then move on to the results of the paper, in which we look at state updates in the ontological models formalism, define how it should work, and then examine the restrictions that it puts on models. We're going to apply these restrictions to the examples that I just listed, and show that they cannot model state update as they are currently defined. And finally, in this like maybe sort of optional footnote appendix thing, I'm going to discuss hidden Markov models and their relationship to the ontological models formalism, in particular that viewed in the right way, they're the exact same thing. I find this interesting because this is currently the tack I'm taking to try to go for a scientisticity kind of thing, although that's in very early stages. But more importantly for this audience, I think that this point of view really clarifies the underlying assumptions and structure of the ontological models formalism in a very interesting way. So without further ado, before we define the ontological models formalism, we need operational theories. So in the context of quantum foundations, and operational theory is just this probability distribution. So it's an experimenter chooses some preparation, transformation, and measurement, and then you get some outcome k from that experiment. For example, you could have, you know, prepare a quantum state, apply a unitary transformation, projective measurement, get an outcome, or this could describe something like preparation being taking a coin out of your pocket, transformation, flip it and cover it up, measurement, look at it. So this has a pretty wide area of application, but we're going to be looking at it for quantum theory. The only other thing you need to define it is these sets of preparations, transformations, and measurements, which is denoted by the curly letters. And for most of this presentation, we'll be talking about modeling the full quantum theory, by which we mean curly P is the set of pure state transformations, curly T is curly T is unitary transformations, and curly M is projective measurements. You might say, wait, there's more than that. So you could take them to be mixed states, CPTP maps, non-projective measurements. But everything we're going to say holds for that case, and we only need the pure state quantum theory for our results. Additionally, you can talk about subtheories, and I'll touch on them briefly. Subtheory is just where you take a subset of the pure states of quantum mechanics, et cetera. For example, the stabilizer subtheory. We take stabilizer states, Clifford transformations, and stabilizer measurements. So from that picture, we can supplement the operational theory with a state. So this is called an ontic state, lambda. What I've drawn here is an influence diagram. So boxes represent an experimenter's choice. Circles represent an uncontrolled random variable. And then arrows represent a potential causal influence. So your original state is only influenced by your choice of preparation, second by the previous state and transformations, and your outcome can be influenced by just the state directly before it and the measurement. In addition, we need to specify the set of possible states, which we denote as big lambda, the ontic state space, as well as conditional probability distributions that correspond to the preparation, transformation, and measurement. So mu is the preparation distribution. It tells you the probability of preparing a particular state given your choice of preparation. Big gamma is the transition matrix, and xi is the response function. And you'll notice that you can read these conditional probabilities directly off of the influence diagram, which is what makes these pictures kind of nice. And if you're a probability theory person, you can just replace all of these symbols with PR, and that's all we mean by them. They're just given special symbols for easy reference and convention. We then need to make sure that our model reproduces our operational theory, for which we have this consistency condition. So over here is just the specification of the operational theory. You factor it according to just the rules of classical probability, and you get this thing on the left-hand side. So as long as this equation is satisfied, our model reproduces our operational theory. You also need normalization on these because they're probability distributions. So within the ontological model's formalism, we can give a well-defined notion of a psi epistemic theory. But we need a couple helper definitions first. The support of a preparation is just the set of ontic states on which it is non-zero. Pretty straightforward. But we also need to be careful of preparation contextuality. So a particular quantum state may have multiple preparations that correspond to it. And for that, we define the support of a quantum state rather than a particular preparation as the union of the supports of all possible preparations of that state. And as long as we're dealing with this object, we don't need to worry about preparation contextuality for the rest of this talk. I should also mention that there's some measure zero issues in all of these things, but we're sort of ignoring that for now, and I promise it works out, I guess. As I said, we can define psi epistemic models. This is not a definition of a psi epistemic model in general. This is like what qualifies as one if it can be described with the ontological model's formalism. So we're not aiming to rule out psi epistemic models as like a holistic class, just the ones within the ontological model's formalism. Which is, I think, all you can do. So we start with saying that two states are ontologically indistinct if their supports overlap. The justification for this is, can't see the colors, sad. The circles each represent the ontic space, and suppose that none of the quantum states overlap. Then you can partition your ontic space into regions corresponding to each quantum state, and then label any ontic space in here, for example, as just like beta, comma, extra variables, which is exactly what happens in the de Broglie-Bohm theory. So we say that that is psi-ontic because you might as well have the quantum state as part of your states of reality. On the other hand, if they overlap, you don't have this one-to-one correspondence, and so we say that the quantum state represents just knowledge about the underlying state. Finally, a ontological model is psi-epistemic if there exists at least one pair of non-identical states that are ontologically indistinct. This is a very weak definition, which is why I put minimally in parentheses. If it were the case that we constructed an epistemic model in which only one pair of quantum states overlaps, and this exists, no one's going to claim that that achieves all of the explanatory power expected from psi-epistemic interpretations. So that list of problems that Matt Liefer says is solved by psi-epistemic interpretations, no one's going to try to claim that a single pair overlapping is going to reproduce that. But it's still very weak, so we want a stronger definition. And this is, in my opinion, the strongest definition. There are other options for strengthening this. But we say that it is pairwise psi-epistemic if all pairs of non-orthogonal states overlap. It's easy to show that orthogonal states must be distinct, which should feel right. So this is as strong as you can get. And these are the two categories that we'll be worried with in this talk. So from here, we can now discuss state update within the ontological models. So the first thing to do is talk about what happens when we add a second measurement. So here I've just taken the ontological models diagram from before and replaced the transformation with another measurement, which also requires another outcome and a bunch more arrows. In quantum theory, we allow a quantum state does depend on the outcome, the choice of measurement, and the previous quantum state. So we allow for dependence on all three of those things, as indicated by the arrows, and so represent it by this state update rule, eta. An important note is that eta is only defined for lambda, which is the pre-measurement state, within the support of the corresponding response function. This is because it's does not make sense to ask what's the next state after this outcome, previous state, and measurement if you couldn't have gotten that outcome in the first place, given the previous state and measurement. And a more rigorous justification of this is coming in the final section if we get there. We again need a new consistency condition. So here, this is our new operational theory specification. Again, we just factor it and get out the left-hand side. And this, again, needs to be normalized. So this is how we model state update. Pretty straightforward, no surprises. I'd also like to note that an arbitrary number of measurements, as well as sort of unifying preparations, transformations, and measurements into a single quantum instrument picture is coming in the a fourth section in case you're curious about that. Yeah.
So I had a question, because in quantum theory for projective measurements,
yeah,
the post-measurement state doesn't depend on the choice of measurement, right?
Rank one projective measurements, it doesn't, but rank two, it does. Yeah. Which is a good point, and we'll discuss that in a second. So we can now move on to our main results. Again, a helper definition. S lambda pi says take a particular ontic state lambda and pick up all of the quantum states for which lambda is in the support. Take all of those quantum states, update them according to the quantum update rule, and now that new set is S lambda pi for some particular ontic state and measurement projector. Our first lemma, which is proven in the paper if you're interested in that, but it just follows from normalization conditions, is that independently of the measurement context of pi, the support of the state update rule must be contained within the intersection of the supports of all of the states in S lambda pi. I would note that the union here would be trivial, but the intersection can be a very restrictive condition. In particular, if this right-hand side is an empty set, then you can't normalize eta if it has the empty set for support. So that's the method we'll use for our main theorem. There are, however, two trivial cases where this doesn't tell you anything interesting. The first is rank one measurements. So no matter how many quantum states you have on this side, for a rank one measurement, you're only going to get one quantum state in this set. There's one state in this set, you're just contained within the support of a state, and that's not surprising or interesting. The other case is for psiontic theories. So in that case, you'll have exactly one quantum state corresponding to a particular ontic state. And again, you'll have one element in the set. Not restrictive. What this tells us is that to find anything interesting with state update, we need to look at rank two measurements in psi epistemic theories, which we're about to do. So our main theorem, which is a little wordy, just says that if a projector maps two states to ontologically distinct states, then the response function, the corresponding response function, cannot have support on the overlap of these two states. And again, this holds independently of the measurement context. You can write it in symbols if you're a very mathy person. There's an important corollary-ish thing, which is that if you have an orthogonalizing measurement, which is what we call a measurement that maps two states to orthogonal states, then this condition is true. The orthogonalizing measurements initially looked very important, and I think they'll be important to generalize this, but it turns out that for the examples we looked at, this version is actually the stronger one. And interestingly, there's a very similar result for transformations in unitaries. And as far as I know, this was originally proved in Matt Leifer's review, but has not been discussed much, which is interesting because this can also rule out a number of epistemic models that are currently considered valid. I think the reason it hasn't been discussed as much is because you can either, there are a lot of arguments for why you don't really need to include transformations. So you can wrap them into your preparation of measurements, but you can't quite do that same thing for multiple sequential measurements unless you do something like, just do a joint distribution. But again, for a section, I'll argue that that's not really what we want from the ontological model's formalism. These look very similar because both state update and transformations are represented by stochastic maps. But the difference is that this doesn't reference a response function. This looks stronger because it just says these states being orthogonally distinct means that these other two states are. And that difference comes from the fact that eta is only defined in the support of xi. So that's why you get this sort of expression. That said, in the examples, the three examples I mentioned earlier, it turns out that this can rule out more of them than the transformations. So there's clearly some symbiosis going on here, but I think there's a lot of good reasons to look at this one primarily. Yeah?
If you assumed what you called the pairwise psi-epistemic model, then this theorem holds if and only if a similar theorem holds, but instead of saying pi maps two states to ontologically distinct states, I could get away with just saying pi maps
Right. So that's like sort of the original tack we took, and the one that initially feels like it'll be productive for a general theorem. But in the examples, using that version of the theorem, we were only able to rule out like any states with overlap less than this can't be overlapping. Whereas using this version, we could rule out all pairs of states. If that didn't feel like a coherent sentence, was it clear?
I think it's sort of interesting, but okay. The things you're trying to rule out are psi epistemic models that are not pairwise psi epistemic. Because if you were only interested in pairwise psi epistemic models, then it wouldn't matter whether you use this theorem or your old version.
Right.
Because they'd be equivalent.
Which is like this weird way in which those two definitions actually come a little bit closer. So like I was saying how you might have, you know, minimally psi epistemic models might have only a single pair of quantum states that overlap. But this at least immediately rules that out. It says that no, it has to be dependent only on the inner product. So it brings those definitions closer together. And yes, that's sort of the challenge. So like the reason these worked to rule out the known theories is that they either are not pairwise psi epistemic or are built out of non-pairwise psi epistemic models. So that's why this is stronger. But yeah, what this sort of suggests is that like you need to go full pairwise psi epistemic if you want any kind of psi epistemic model.
Okay, so I think I understand that. So earlier you said, okay, there's minimally psi epistemic, there's pairwise psi epistemic. It says something to the effect of, you know, I think pairwise psi epistemic is a more reasonable thing. And I was thinking, and therefore you're going to assume it. But in fact, what you're saying is that you don't even need to assume it. You can essentially derive it from these kinds of results. You can say, well, look, if you're just willing to grant me minimal psi epistemic, then I can push you to adopt the pairwise psi epistemic approach based on these kinds of theorems.
Right, you can't get all the way there as yet, at least not, you know, quickly, but yeah, that's essentially what's going on.
But to some extent, it means that that distinction is not so important any longer, because if you take even the minimal assumption, you're sort of pushed to the...
Right, so the only thing, so actually both of these conditions so far I've found give the same exact restriction of the kind that you're talking about, which says that, can everyone read that? Should I try another one?
There are some lights at the corner.
Heading over here?
Yeah, thank you. You write all.
Oh, thanks. So, if this is true, then psi phi being distinct implies psi prime and phi prime being distinct. So you can derive this, you can't derive this just from including unitary transformations. You actually need to include CPTP maps. But you can derive this directly from the measurement version I've shown, which is not in this paper, using just projective measurements. You don't need non-projective measurements, which I think is kind of nice.
I think you might have the primes on the wrong side of that implication. Psi prime and phi prime were orthogonal. Left-hand side would be zero. That inequality would be respected. But I wouldn't be able to infer that...
Why not?
Oh, sorry. If psi and phi are ontologically distinct...
Right, then that would mean that, so if they're orthogonal, that would mean this side is zero, so this side has to be zero. So that means that these are also ontologically distinct. And this, again, is in Liefer's review. Yeah. But I've got an alternative proof using just measurements rather than transformations.
We don't get close to a bound,
though.
We got close to a bound, right?
What do you mean?
Like, which pairs of states can have a...
No, that was a like piece of a conjecture that didn't end up working out.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, this is sort of the like highest level, like most quantum version of these things. This is like the lowest level, most ontological models version of this thing. And these are more useful in the examples. I would love to get something stronger than this, but this like feels very intuitively nice also, so it may be as good as we can do.
This is just saying if two states overlap, the prime states overlap less in the Hilbert space sense than the unprime state, then they also overlap less in the ontological sense.
Exactly. Which is just, again, how, you know, CPTP maps are related directly to the stochastic maps that we use to represent them in ontological models. This also, you know, suggests that ontological distinctness might just be a function of inner product, which is sort of the train of thought that led to the maximally psi-epistemic condition, which has its own issues, but that I think is the motivation there. Any more questions about the main results before we go on to the examples?
Well, is that the main result? What is the main result?
Right, so this is like our main result in the sense that it's the most general statement of things we found. And then I'll get to the like punchline later.
Okay, because I didn't get the punchline.
Yeah, this is not a punchline. This is a bunch of symbols. Yeah, I agree. Okay. Got everything there. Right, so now on to examples, I'll get to the important part in a second. So as far as I know, there are three published psi-epistemic models that fit within the ontological model's formalism. LJBR and ABCL are similar, although they are distinct. And they're both defined for the full quantum theory in arbitrary dimension. Was that like the sun setting in the... Oh, okay. Kitchen sink is not for the full quantum theory, but it is defined for arbitrary finite subtheories. Finite subtheory, I just mean a finite number of measurements. All of these can reproduce a single preparation and single measurement. These two are both pairwise psi-epistemic, and this is like a pairwise psi-epistemic version of this one, basically. Just to outline the structure of the proof, since I don't want to go through the whole thing, the idea is to pick an arbitrary pair of states, construct a projector, and the projector has to meet two conditions. First of all, it maps the states to ontologically distinct states, so we can use theorem one to conclude that the response function is zero. And then from the model definition, we can just calculate the response function for this thing, and we'll construct one such that it's one contradiction, and so therefore, we cannot represent state update in these models without further modifications. Initially, there were some like very trivial modifications that were escaping, but you know, I played with it a tiny bit, and there aren't any quick modifications to these that will allow that. Yeah.
So is this a strengthening of the result originally?
Yeah, this is archive version two.
There's no more
overlap conditions. Yeah. Yep. That's yeah. And again, so that the stronger result is from using the more elementary version of that theorem versus the orthogonalizing measurement one. Did you have a question?
Are you sure that the response function is one everywhere in the ontological overlap?
These are all outcome deterministic models, so yeah.
What was the definition of psi again?
Psi is the response function, so it corresponds to the...
what does it mean it equals one?
So we can do our Venn diagram. Pierce hates these Venn diagrams. So say this is the support of your two ontic states, right? And in principle, you could have a response function. So this is the set of states that will respond to this measurement that have any probability of giving the outcome corresponding to this distribution. So this is like pi. And what this is saying is just that this region can't exist.
What is the meaning of the formula
like
C equals 1?
Oh, sorry. So this is diagramming the support. Really, you could like...
You mean it's 1? It's either 1 or 0 everywhere?
In this case, it is 1 or 0 everywhere. Generally, it can be just a probability distribution. or a conditional probability distribution. So it sounds like it's not normalized if it's just 0 or 1, but that's, yeah.
So it's just 0 or 1, but it still could be that in the region of logic overlap, it's 0 in some places and 1 in other places. Are you showing that it's 1 everywhere?
Yeah, this is for any lambda in that overlap.
That's how you construct.
Yeah.
So the second step you construct the gas, that's why you write the response function is called a function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's trivial to construct this, not trivial, but like you can construct this projector such that this is true for any model, as you said, via the orthogonalizing measurements. But then this part comes from the definition of the model itself. So like we just evaluate the response function for that projector.
And it sounds like you're looking to the model to figure out how to construct the projector.
Right, yeah. This is like a post-reconstructed Lakatoshian whatever thing. But it's like, yeah, we want this to be true and we want that to be true, and then we construct a projector satisfying those constraints. Yeah.
So this is not for all models. You just picked 3 specific models.
I picked all of the known examples of cybestemic models.
These 3 fail.
Yes.
To a contradiction.
Yeah. So it's just a few examples. Doesn't sound very impressive.
I don't know.
Yeah. So the punchline then is that we have scientificity theorems, but all of these scientificity theorems require at least one additional assumption. So PBR, for example, requires preparation independence, which is like halfway to Bell's set of assumptions for locality. There are others by Renner, Kolbeck, but they all have one additional assumption, and it was thought that because these models exist, you need that one additional assumption, that we're not gonna be able to just rule out cybestemic theories as a class. But what we've shown here is that because these can't reproduce state update, if you want your models to reproduce state update, it's now possible to, well, it was always possible, but we now realize it's possible to construct a scientificity theorem with no additional assumptions. I wish I could tell you I have. It's hard. But yeah, that's the idea. And beyond that, like, I don't think anyone really likes these models in the first place. They feel very artificial and constructed and non-physical. So this is sort of a very concrete way of saying, yeah, they actually are not great for this particular reason.
So I didn't hear some words you said, but I think you say scientificity, or what was that word? But anyway, is the claim of the punchline that the way is open, you've opened up the way to completely ruling out all of the so-called psi epistemic models.
To ruling out all of the psi epistemic models that can be described by the ontological models formalism, but essentially, yeah. Yeah. I should say reopened because we thought we could and then we thought we couldn't. Now it looks like we can, yeah. Right, one quick note about the kitchen sink is that this actually depends on what the subtheory is. Obviously, you can just choose a subtheory that only has rank one measurements. Rank one measurements are not constrained by our theorem, so that works. But you only need like 2 states and a measurement that orthogonalizes those states, and that's all you need for the kitchen, and a measurement to distinguish the post-updated states. And that's all you need. Those requirements are satisfied by the stabilizer subtheory for multiple qubits, prime dimension, at least. So the kitchen sink, importantly, cannot model the stabilizer subtheory. That said, there are epistemic models of the stabilizer subtheory. So the n quapit, so odd prime qubits, have a very straightforward one via the Wigner function, where we constructed a state update map, because state update maps they're not CPTP, but they are CP. And CP maps are well defined in quasi-probability representations. And then we showed that it is positive for all stabilizer measurements. And then the n-qubit one is much messier, but Piers has worked it out. And both of these models are cybestemic, Wigner function being pairwise cybestemic. This one not quite getting there. What this tells us, then, in addition to knowing that we need to include state update in a potential scientificity theorem, this says that we also need to include non-stabilizer stabilizer states, transformations, or measurements in a potential scionticity theorem. So in particular, the PBR theorem only uses stabilizer states and measurements. So this just tells us that that's not going to rule out things without additional assumptions. Yeah.
The inequality qubit by Vigor. So Lorenzo Catani did some work on Vigor representations. Was his work sufficient to show that there existed a scientific model for the state update or inequalities? My vague recollection of what he'd done.
Yeah, he did. I forget if he like specifically emphasized that they're cyepistemic, and I don't love their construction and notation. The rule that I wrote down is the same thing, just expressed in the ontological model's vocabulary rather than your toy model vocabulary, which is what they did. Yeah, I think that summarizes the differences.
Less than clear thought, but what you said at the end about needing more than what you could an operational subtheory that admits an ontological model. Does that follow from the fact that if there were a theorem of proof that the only models of quantum theory are scientific models? Because scientific models are preferentially contextual and non-local and all that, you can kind of derive all those other NOCO results.
Yeah, which is a great note.
It feels like that would be another way of justifying this,
I don't know about justifying, but this definitely falls in line with the idea that like the stabilizer subtheory is classical, which is maybe what you were getting at with the contextuality stuff.
I guess my concern would be something like if you took a theory. Maybe this is consistent with what you say. If you took a theory where it's known that there's a preparation ontological model, and you showed that it had to be psiontic, that wouldn't make sense because psiontic models are preparation contextual. That would be a contradiction.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But in a sense, if there's any hope for sort of showing that some subtheory has to be psiontic, well, then you're going to have enough operational structure to show that it's also preparation contextual.
Right.
And so you're going to need more than, for example, the stabilizer form for quant bits to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I was talking to Matt Leifer about this. He wanted to get more into the relationship between these ideas and contextuality. The inclusion of the state update rule actually slightly modifies your generalized contextuality definition for measurements. And at least for non-destructive measurements, it breaks the proof in your paper on that. The two measurements you use are no longer operationally equivalent. I haven't pushed too far into the contextuality stuff because it makes me nervous. But there's definitely relationships here between contextuality and the state update stuff. So again, just a quick note on transformations. I said that the update maps were a little bit more powerful. LJBR definitely can't do transformations. ABCL, it'll be really messy if it does exist, but it's not exactly ruled out just because any pairwise cyepistemic model can, in principle, represent transformations because that condition is satisfied. Finally, and more importantly, the kitchen sink actually can represent transformations as long as your subtheory is closed, so your measurements will only map you to states that are already in your subtheory, and this is the case for the stabilizer subtheory. So the kitchen sink can model transformations for the stabilizer subtheory, but can't model state update for the stabilizer subtheory. Mostly a side note, but for thoroughness. And this is just what I was saying here. That to get this condition from transformations, you need full CPTP maps, but you can get it from state update considering only projective measurements, not non-projective ones. I kind of like to pause for questions a little bit before I go on to the final section, which is a little less related. If anyone's got, yeah.
I think you just said, if you need CPTP maps, you mean not just unitaries, you need non-unitaries.
Right, so if you have unitaries, this turns into an equal sign. But with CPTP maps, it's less than equal. It's just from the know, corresponding to the idea that unitaries preserve inner products, CPTV maps can only decrease it.
Right. I was wondering whether that's such a big difference if I were to conceive of that non-unitary map as Stein's primarily as unitary on a larger system.
Right, then you need to include appending a new system, which again is straightforward in the same way that state update is straightforward. Yeah, it's hazy exactly where those distinctions come in, I agree. I don't think this is a big deal. I just think it's nice to have an alternate proof in terms of projective measurements. Sort of like the most straightforward way to try to go for a generalized scientist theorem from the state update conditions results exactly in this. And I was a little surprised to see that. But it was, like I was saying, there's some symbiosis going on between the transformations and state update.
So you're not going to show more of the proof. So I just want to, I think you sort of hinted what the basic idea is. Well, I just want to see if I got it right.
Mm-hmm.
That if you had two orthogonal states, you would somehow know that their supports couldn't overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick of using this update is to project two states which are not orthogonal onto ones which are orthogonal. And use that fact for the resulting states.
Yeah, so the...
To somehow...
Yeah, okay. So the post-update states don't actually need to be orthogonal. They just need to be ontologically distinct, which is the ontological model's version of orthogonal. So, yeah, essentially. Yep.
But in particular, if they were... would suffice if they were...
Yes, yeah, that's a sufficient condition.
That's a sufficient... And the other question, maybe it's not suitable now, but I'm not really sure what a stabilizer subtheory is. Is it a long story to?
It's half a page in my appendix.
Okay, never mind.
If you want to look at that, but there's not that really short version. Rolls Fourier transforms and stuff that I can't rattle off the top of my head. Okay, yeah.
Is there a more quantitative version of this kind of result? Like the first part, the top line is quantitative, but the second line is kind of more qualitative in some sense.
Something like that. Oh, you mean like including measure theory, not just like writing it in math symbols?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, there's something like that. I have avoided doing measure theory unless someone makes me, so.
Okay.
Huh? Yeah. Okay, if there aren't any more questions about that, I'm gonna move on to my little pet theory thing. So I forget if I said this in the intro, but this is related to an idea I have for generalizing the scionticity result without any extra assumptions, although that's very preliminary and I'm getting a little discouraged about it. So more importantly, I did say this, goes into more of the structure of the ontological model's formalism and the assumptions underlying it. I would like to warn you, prepare yourselves for a horrible figure. This is a stochastic channel. Forget, I know this looks a lot like a picture you've seen before, forget that for a second, because I want to pretend like they're completely different things for a second. A stochastic channel is just a thing where you have inputs and outputs. So these can come from any alphabet. For example, you could have A come from the set 0, 1, and K also. And then these arrows just say that you can have arbitrary dependence on the past, arbitrary causal dependence. An example of a state that does have arbitrary causal dependence would be one where you input a 0 and a 1, or a 1, and it will output the same thing as long as, so for a 1, it'll just output the 1. If it's a 0, then it only inputs the 0 if there has been an even block of 1s before it. Just sort of a pathological little example that needs arbitrary memory, or not arbitrary memory, but arbitrary dependence on the past.
What is this past title, initial conditions, or just
previous inputs and outputs?
Diagram that you haven't shown.
Yeah, so you can think of this either as like bi-infinite strings, So like infinite past inputs and outputs, or like just some arbitrary length finite string. Some of the math looks nicer if you do the by infinite stuff, although that makes a little less sense for, I think it makes sense in a sort of nice way for quantum theory in that like you never actually get a new system, right? It has an arbitrary long history. That's mostly a side point. Right, just it's just you can think of this as a repeated use channel. So like if this were an IID channel, you wouldn't have any arrows besides the one from A to K in the same time step. And as before, time is going this way. So notice that we could have arrows going like that way as well, but we've restricted to a causal channel, so influences only propagate forwards in time. Which, I don't know, seems reasonable. Right, gave my example. This is a lot of arrows. We'd rather not deal with all of that dependence. So we can use what's called a hidden Markov model, which is, this might look familiar. We supplement that view with a state, lambda, and the lambda, the state essentially functions as a memory. Rather than depending on the infinite past, the outcome is only going to depend on the previous state. So you induce this like Markov dynamics over this potentially non-Markovian process. And it's called hidden Markov model because the idea is you have access sort of only to these outputs and not to the state itself. Additionally, they render the past and future conditionally independent, which is just another way of saying the Markov condition. So like the probability of the whole future conditioned on the past, on the, sorry, the current state in the past is equal to just the probability of the future conditioned on the current state. A hidden Markov model exists for any stochastic channel. This is a thing that you can always write down. It might not be nice, it might not actually give you any advantage, but in the case of the example I gave where you need an even block of ones, you can represent that by a hidden Markov model that only needs two states. So it just remembers, have I done an even block of ones or an odd block of ones most recently? And so that reduces your arbitrary length past dependence to dependence on just a pair of states. So these things can be very powerful computationally. This is how you describe a hidden Markov model. It's just because we've induced this Markovian condition, or Markov property, it's just the probability of an outcome and the next state given the input and the previous state. All this might look familiar if we go back to the ontological model diagram and then just click back and forth a few times. I don't think anyone's surprised. But there's a couple of things that have happened. First of all, we always have an outcome, whereas we have preparations and transformations that don't have outcomes, and we've gone to an arbitrary number of actions. And these actions are like just from an arbitrary alphabet. They're not necessarily divided into preparations, transformations, and measurements. So to look at this mathematically, we first say that our input alphabet is just the union of preparations, transformations, and measurements. We take, this is our specification of a hidden Markov model, one version of Bayes' rule. And then we just identify these two probability distributions with objects from the ontological model's formalism. So if A is a preparation, then this is just equal to mu. And we just say that there's a trivial output. So it could be you just always get a zero out if you do a preparation, or it could be you get a random output, as long as it doesn't carry any information. But here we've chosen you get zero every time. Same idea with the transformation. And then we just see that the only difference is that a preparation is a transformation that doesn't depend on the previous state, which is exactly what we want. Finally, our measurement representation is the full joint distribution in its full generality. And if we had done this before defining state updates, we would have, you know, had names for all of these things and then something left, and it's like, oh, the missing thing from the ontological model's formalism is this state update rule, which I think is nice. This also emphasizes the limited domain of eta. So we can always find xi from this joint distribution. If we take this joint distribution to be a little more fundamental, which I think it is, you can find xi by just marginalizing over lambda prime. But then to find eta, you need to divide that by xi. So that's just a straightforward way of saying that eta is only defined when xi is non-zero, so within its support. I see a yawn or two, so what? There's been work done in the hidden Markov models framework to really dig at what kinds of stochastic processes you can model by them. So here I have what I think is a relatively complete description of the assumptions of the ontological models formalism. I know it's dangerous to say a complete set of assumptions, but pretty reasonable. And I also find them very minimal. So A, we can represent nature via a stochastic channel. Feels nice. The process is causal, so influence only propagates forward in time. Again, we mostly hope that's true in physics. The process is stationary, which in physics speak is time translation invariance. Again, we hope that our time origin doesn't affect our physical processes. And finally, that the states of the system render the past and future conditionally independent. This is just saying that the states form a hidden Markov model of the channel. I put real in parentheses because you don't really need any sense of real anything in here. I think that the definition of psi epistemic models as being epistemic comes from that additional real thing, but just in this framework, that's not strictly necessary. This is really much more about how we model the world than what the world really is. I forgot to mention I'm getting back on a soapbox. The idea here is that given A, we're struggling to construct a psi epistemic ontological model, even more so if we include state update, and B, that there may actually be a scienticity theorem. I think it's reasonable to start trying to think about how we might break the assumptions of the ontological model's formalism to still find a psi epistemic interpretation, because I think there are a lot of good qualitative arguments for epistemic interpretations. But how do we break these? I don't know. They feel very, very natural and minimal. My one sort of observation is just that they all seem to have to do with time and causality, which, I don't know, we shouldn't be surprised because we've been trying to figure out what time and causality are for like at least 2,000 years, much longer really, and I think that we really don't have a good understanding of them. Along with the fact that this could be like a way, like thinking about time and causality really specifically, could be a way to link the very like quantum information computational picture that the ontological models formalism gives us to like a more physical idea that would maybe connect more naturally, if ambitiously, to ideas in quantum gravity. Off the soapbox again. That's all I wanted to say about that, so here's a quick summary. Thanks for your attention. Any further questions?
Okay. Can you go back one slide? I don't know which one to point at, but you're using a linear time. So have you thought about quantum field theory time is really a partial order. It's not
right.
A total order.
Yeah.
How well have you tried to generalize these results to that case?
No, the farthest I've gotten in like thinking about getting away from these assumptions is being like, what if there are multiple time dimensions? What if there are multiple time dimensions?
Okay.
Which I have like further justification for that idea. I don't take it too seriously. But that's just to say, no, I haven't really thought about that in particular.
Even within what, I mean, it's really wrong. There is no linear time.
Okay.
It's a fact of nature now.
Okay.
It's not, so you don't have to add another time direction.
Sure.
So.
Does this work in ordered?
I don't know what the right setting is.
Yeah, I don't know if this would.
The setup you've done presupposes a distinguished time function.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Slicing of space.
So you're saying even just going to special relativity, we can say that that's not
relativity.
Right.
It's already breaking a little bit out of your framework.
Yeah. So when you go there, then you just induce sort of product distributions or the product structure on your inputs and outputs. And as long as you're not going fully to quantum field theory, just special relativity, then you just get exactly Bell's locality condition. So incorporating that kind of thing, I'm not saying it's straightforward, but like at least an elementary version of it is just what Bell's theorem looks like. But definitely that is one path to move away from these things.
You have a definition of a, whatever you call it, ontological model or stochastic ontological model. I forgot your terminology.
Yeah.
Definition of that in the case of Minkowski space or in the case of a...
Right. So what I would say is that...
It's not a linear order.
Yeah, you get like sort of a Cartesian product in your space-time, right? You say like these two things are, like no causal influence can travel, right, is all we really need. And then all you have is conditional independences. So like, sorry, am I not addressing your question?
Well, maybe implicitly, but not explicitly.
Okay.
I mean, at the beginning you showed a picture with a sort of linear progression of what replaces that picture.
So I think the key is that if you're looking at non-local systems, you need a sense of subsystems, which this also doesn't have built into it. You get subsystems very straightforwardly by doing this Cartesian product thing, right? And it doesn't induce any notion of locality initially, except for just the idea that we actually can distinguish subsystems. And then from there, you can just say that those subsystems' outcomes have to be independent.
I mean, I'm willing to take Minkowski space as it is.
Okay.
I'm not asking you to go beyond that.
I'm only going as far as Minkowski space.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, you would need like a spatial...
Is your subsystem a region of Minkowski?
Right, exactly, yeah.
So then you shouldn't analyze further. Anyway, I think new questions.
Yes, absolutely.
When you try to do that. I'm not sure that the notion of psi... whatever you call it, ontological models. What do you call them?
The ontological models, psi epistemic models, psi ontic.
Anyway, the first thing you got.
Yeah.
The general set of models you're considering.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's that well defined in the context of actual space time.
Right. So two answers. One, as I'm trying to say, I think it like works out if you move to a space time picture. But also, this just applies to local systems, and you still want a sense of psi epistemicity, still working on that word, for just localized systems, I think is, like, yes, it'll be interesting to put this onto space-time, but you don't need to go there to look at the question of psi epistemicness. Does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else?
Is that if you leave it to kind of try to test isomorphism, you might be able to find a kind of prepare and measure experiment that could also get closer to a psi ontic theorem. So insofar as the state update rule, you learn some outcome and it teaches you something about how the input ontic state and the output ontic state are related. You can imagine a kind of entanglement swapping experiment where, you know, I condition on the outcome of some joint measurement here, and it teaches me something about how these two input ontic states are related.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that those things are pretty analogous.
Yeah.
And maybe you have already enough structure there so that any proof of scienticity in using state update could be done in those kinds of setups.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a possibility.
Of a more familiar context in which to...
Mm-hmm.
About those things.
Right, like from the fact that I got the same exact condition out, and from that or like Nymark dilation, I think that definitely it's possible. You can only get the same, like state update doesn't actually give you anything over transformations or even prepare measure. The justification being that, you know, relatively simply, we were able to show those properties. And also that, I think of like measurement update as like a little more fundamental than the whole Choi-Jamolkowski thing, like appending subsystems, and I also haven't reconciled that idea with the fact that like ABCL and LGBR can do prepare and measure experiments. If you want to, yeah.
Clarify what I was saying, because I think maybe you thought of something else. I'm not saying that replace state update with a pure prepare and measure scenario or even compare transform measure scenario where the transformation has no outcome. I'm thinking of something different from both those, which would be something like a prepare and measure scenario with post-selection, right? So something like an entanglement swapping experiment where you've got, you know, two pairs of systems, a measurement in the middle, a measurement on each of the ends. You'd say, now let's consider what happens when I post-select on some outcome in the middle, right? So now I'm sort of talking about prepare and measure for the rest of the systems, but it's on the condition of this post-selection. So I'm thinking that those post-selections could play exactly the same, like the middleman in a state update sort of thing, is you've got like three time steps and you post-select on the outcome in the middle, relating these guys. Mm-hmm. But you can do the same thing if you've got three measurements and you're post-selecting on the middle one. It's just now they're space-like separated.
Yeah.
They're not identical scenarios. Yep. In your scenario, you could signal, and in this scenario, you could not.
Right.
But my guess would be that whatever you're going to leverage to prove scienticity, maybe you'll find it in that space-like scenario as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not quite prepare and measure because it's got post-selection in it, but it's more similar to things that people have talked about.
Right, definitely. So, I was going to say, first of all, if you're post-selecting anything, I feel like that implies measurement update. And that sort of change of measurement update into space-like separation is exactly what happens in Bell's theorem, right?
Yeah.
So like the influence diagram that I drew, if you do that for just prepare and measure, if you like rotate the time arrow to up, you get the Bell scenario, or down, I forget which one. So yes, there's definitely a connection there. That then assuming here's the thing, that then assumes locality, right? The idea that locality follows from scienticity. And I would rather go straight from scienticity and then get to locality rather than presupposing locality. Yeah. Because like Bell's theorem already tells us that like the kind of epistemicness that could explain non-local correlations can't explain non-local correlations.
I mean, you're making some causal assumptions.
Yeah.
Like the fact that the ontic state does screen off the preparation from the measurement.
Yeah.
That assumption could be very comparable to the notion that the common cause ontic states in Bell experiments are screening off, and there aren't direct influences between it. So it's not so clear to me that assuming locality is such a stronger assumption than what you've already assumed here. You know, no direct arrows from the preparation variable over to the measurement that don't go through lambda.
So that particular thing, two and four have previously been identified by Matt Leifer and Matt Pusey. They call this non-retro causality, call this lambda mediation. And that's where they do the influence diagrams and rotate it for Bell stuff. And to acknowledge that, that lambda mediation thing that you were talking about, I don't know what state means if it doesn't mean that, first of all. If you have a state plus dependence on the past, then the state isn't really capturing the state of the system in terms of capturing all of its physical properties, which is the justification for the ontological model's formalism. Slash that lambda mediation is not a new assumption. That's an assumption built into the ontological model's formalism.
It still strikes me very similar to in the case of locality. Say, all right, well, the alternative is that there's some cause-effect relation that proceeds superluminally from one wing to the other, and it has nothing to do with the ontic states of the pairs of systems that came from the source.
Mm-hmm.
So if I said, look, there's a direct causal influence of your preparation device and your measurement device that happens not to be mediated by the ontic states of the system that passes between them,
right.
It feels very similar.
Yeah, definitely. Have you looked at Matt Leifer and Matt Pusey's article on time symmetry and retrocausality?
A while ago, yeah.
Okay, because they go into that sort of analogy. So I think that's definitely true, but... I think that locality is stronger in the sense that, for example, de Broglie-Bohm or just like Belchmeta-Bugaisky is non-local while still respecting this time causal structure, that independence of state, that shielding state kind of thing. That wasn't English. De Broglie-Bohm theory respects all of these assumptions while not respecting the assumption of locality. in fact, just like physics obeys these assumptions, generally how we talk about it.
Not quite in tune with
okay.
making that comment right now. Let me just see if we can get more agreement on the comment before.
So sure.
If we only had two layers, like prepare and measure,
yep.
and then the distinction I just talked about wouldn't be that relevant, right? If I said, okay, there's those causal influences that propagate by virtue of the ontic state of the system, and then there's these other causal influences, which are some sort of like ghostly causal inference from here to there, you could just respond, oh, well, I'm just going to define my ontic state space to be not necessarily associated with the thing you call the system, but just any causal influence propagating between them. The ontic state captures that. It captures everything, the ghost, particles, whatever. But if you have three layers, as you do, right, then there could be causal influences that don't go through the middle operation, that go around it, that that directly influence the second measurement, say, from the preparation. And that's the thing that wouldn't be captured by making the ontic state spaces of lambda and lambda prime arbitrarily large, because you can't really describe anything which is a causal influence that doesn't go into that middle box. So that's the sense in which there's more generality beyond your framework, right? You could say that. So what I'm saying is implicitly in your framework, when you start talking about these three levels, you've made an assumption that there are no causal influences that are leapfrogging over the intermediate measurement.
Right.
That assumption is just as consequential as the assumption of locality. And I don't think, therefore, that arguments for scienticity that make that assumption will be somehow more plausible, assuming less than an argument for scienticity that assumed locality. Or at least I haven't heard the argument that would persuade me of that.
So as soon as you're jumping around the middle thing, I think you lose this sort of stationarity time translation kind of thing, right? Like if you can't jump over the first one, why should you be able to jump over two of them kind of thing?
You're jumping over one, so you got like three boxes.
Let me bring up that. So like here, where's the arrow going?
Yes, it would go straight from... Okay, well, I haven't thought about it in this language, but let's see. So here, all the influences between P and K prime are mediated through lambda and lambda prime. Right? So if I conditional lambda on the prime, P and K prime are independent. So suppose I imagine that there was a direct influence from P to K prime. It was not mediated by lambda and lambda prime.
And you're saying that would be significantly different from ignoring this stuff and saying just from P to K.
So
arrow from P to K wouldn't set up correlations from P to K prime that were made independent by conditioning a lambda to lambda prime. So I would put in an arrow directly from P to K prime.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking is like in just a prepare and measure once experiment, what is your justification for there not being an arrow here?
Well, I guess I would want to absorb that arrow into the lambda and say, so if you start off by saying lambda is the ontic state of the system that propagates between the devices, then you might say, okay, well, under that definition, lambda is going to be its thing, and there's going to be this another influence from P to K. But if somebody came along and said, no, I don't want to define the ontic state as having to do with the spin a half particle that's mediating between them. I just want to call it, you know, the physical state of any causal influence that goes from P to K. And so it wouldn't make sense then to draw a second arrow from P to K. I would just say, well, lambda includes all those arrows.
Okay.
But the problem is that an arrow from P to K prime, would you want to just include that, I guess, as going through lambda and lambda primes?
Right. My like one maybe will convince you response is like, can we wrap all of this into, we can wrap all of this into one lambda, and then your same argument holds. Right, like exactly in the way that we can, maybe this doesn't quite work, but like sort of the way that we can wrap all of this into a preparation, we would still want there to be no arrows from this whole block to K that weren't mediated by lambda. And side note, this whole block is usually what we mean by a preparation, right? We're usually post-selecting on a measurement to prepare a pure state.
But if you wrap the whole thing, then you don't have repeat measurements, right?
Right, I'm trying to get, Rob is saying,
Yeah, but what Rolf's point only comes about if you have repeated measurements, like repeated, say.
Right. So. Yeah, I think Rob is trying to say that this is different from the situation with only a single preparation and measurement. I'm trying to say that they're more similar. Maybe.
I don't know. My overall point is just that it seems to me that you're making an assumption that's very analogous to the kind of assumption that somebody might make in locality. So suppose we imagine somebody who said, hey, I posit that there's a causal influence from one wing to the other of the Bell experiment that's not mediated by any physical systems. Okay.
Yeah. Cats.
Geese.
One goose, one cat.
Oh yeah, it just flew away.
So if somebody came along and said, and somebody else said, I posit a causal influence from P to K prime that's not mediated by any physical system, you would have to respond, but I model your causal influence as something that is mediated by lambda and lambda prime.
Yeah.
Isn't that derived though from, you were saying that the hidden Markov model, you said you can always represent these causal influences.
Yeah.
There always exists a hidden Markov model.
Mm-hmm.
Where you've included that influence through lambda.
And certainly you could like weaken the definition of a hidden Markov model being one that like doesn't capture all of the, like it doesn't capture all of the path dependence. That feels like you immediately lose everything that you've got. Like, and yeah, I don't know, I don't want to like change, like ignore your argument and change tacks, but like to me this is like what state means. Like, it means a thing that renders the future conditionally independent of the past.
Well, this is related to what I wanted to make a general comment, which I don't think you've heard before, but people here probably. This is related. I want to question, you say, what do you need to give up?
Yeah.
So I think there's two things that need to be given up, which in some sense, one of which everyone knows you should give up, but somehow it's forgotten, which is the idea that you can use a stochastic model, that you can use classical probabilities to describe the quantum world. I mean, from one point of view, the whole lesson of quantum mechanics is that you can't do it. And the second, and the physics word that underpins that is interference, right? I mean, classical probability models exclude interference. The second thing I think you need to give up is state.
I'm so on board with that.
You're on board with that. Okay.
Yeah. That's like the conclusion I want to draw, among other things, from,
Oh, please do.
I mean, go ahead. I'd love to hear you.
Go ahead. No, I'd rather hear you.
Just like,
a million times.
I don't know, this has lessened, but for a while I was just really annoyed with the idea of a state because people kept saying it without investigating. So, people often call interpretations realist or anti-realist without saying what they're realist or anti-realist about.
Exactly.
And as I tried to emphasize in the beginning, I think it's state realism and state anti-realism.
I probably missed the first 5 minutes.
And so they're distinguished by being realist about the quantum state or not realist about the quantum state, and realist about some other kind of state or not realist about any kind of state. So that leads them to annoyance with the word state. But then I come up against the fact that like physics without a state, like I think the power of physics comes from the idea of a state, right? Even in like economics, when they draw on physics, they're saying, oh, this whole economic system has a state and we can infer future states from the current state, is sort of my take on that. So I see a distinct tension that I don't know how to resolve. Yeah.
Well, instead of a state, you have the idea of history. That's the more relativistic way of thinking about things, and it doesn't directly involve the notion of state.
Right. So two comments on that. One, going back to you can't describe quantum mechanics with classical probability. My answer being, yes, you can. Just it gets gross. If you've seen the Belchmedi-Bugaisky model, we just say that, and this. It's going to look kind of trivial, and it kind of is, but I think it's an important note, which is just we take the ontic space to be a projective Hilbert space if I can do curly things. The preparation, I'm going to write it as if it's non-contextual, is just delta function that says we prepare that state. Transformations. It's ununitary. Similarly, you've got like a delta function between lambda prime and like u lambda. Right, so it's in these kinds, it's in this sense that we are modeling things with classical probability theory.
Are these all one and zero probability? I don't.
Yeah, these are all one and zero, and then you get non-outcome determinism. So of psi given lambda or pi, some projector, for example, is then the trace of.
Yeah, but these are probabilities. I know, these are.
Yeah, sorry.
Really, probabilities of the physical events we're interested in. They're probabilities of some artificial framework. Let's call it artificial.
Sure.
It has 100 years of history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That you've set up.
Right, and I think the idea is that we're trying to investigate.
Really understand the physical events that you're really interested in.
Right, so this is definitely taking a sort of operational point of view.
Yeah, that's taking that point. But just think, I mean, there's obviously reasons why people say you don't use classical probability.
Right.
Diffraction is the classic example of that kind of reason.
Right, and what I'm trying to say is that, like,
you can't attribute, in a naive sense, probabilities to the individual histories. I mean, I'm just repeating what's in any textbook. You can't attribute probabilities to the individual histories as a particle in such a way that you get this interference pattern. But if you attribute amplitudes rather than probabilities, then you do get the interference pattern. So you're dealing with some sort of replacement of probability theory. This is all thrown away in this way of talking and saying that we should take as our fundamental framework just classical probability theory. Now why? I mean, you could fit anything into anything. I could describe a sphere as a subset of flat space by making identifications and cutting it into pieces and so on, but it's completely artificial and unnatural from that point of view. So if you're looking to ask foundational questions, why ask them in a context where everything is distorted, rearranged,
right,
into some other framework?
So
it's not natural to quantum theory. That's all I'm saying. For the first point, anyway.
Yeah, so I think what you're articulating is what I see as like a qualitative argument for a psi epistemic interpretation, right? We say, oh, quantum mechanics looks a lot like subjective probabilities. Like, it looks like this new version of probability theory, right? And that's a lot of the reasoning for why.
New kind of probability.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I find a very convincing argument for saying that it's quantum mechanics describes something like knowledge or something like belief, which is what we mean by a psi epistemic or a doxastic interpretation. When I'm looking at that, at this, I'm seeing this as a description, not of reality, but of our theory, right? Which is going to be artificial, as you said. And like in sort of a Heisenberg kind of sense, like classical probability theory is the way we think and talk.
Well, we have to learn to do.
Sure, sure. That's one way to go.
Well, isn't that the point of quantum foundations?
Yes, I think the idea of psi epistemic interpretations is we want to not give up too much in making that change. So the lesson is, if we can't have psi epistemic interpretations, maybe we do need to give up that much, is, I think, the conclusion.
Okay, but the other thing is, I don't think, and this gets into a longer story, but I don't think that, well, as I said, I don't think psi is a fundamental notion at all.
Okay.
But to the extent that it enters into the theory, and I mean, I'm talking about a path integral framework, what I would call
okay.
a histories-based framework. And to the extent that a state enters at all, which it does in intermediate steps, It is more, I'm not sure it fits either camps, epistemic or ontic, but I think it fits a little more ontic. But it functions as a kind of summary of the past, partial summary of the past.
Right.
To the extent that the past is something real, Shai is also something real. Right, the preparation is something real.
Mm-hmm.
And if Shai is partly representing that preparation, then it's something real to that extent. So I don't think it's just a pure case of knowledge. It has an objective context.
Okay, so what I want to say about like everything up to the last sentence is just that people have done a lot of work constructing hidden Markov models for like these kinds of arbitrary channels. And there's this very nice canonical hidden Markov model you get from a history's point of view. So you take the set of all pasts and you induce an equivalence relation on it. You say that two pasts are equivalent if they make equivalent probabilistic predictions for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that partitions the set of pasts, and if right from there you get a hidden Markov model.
You could do that, but the state space of this Markov model would grow.
No, that's the thing, is that like this thing where it, so like the example I gave where it has arbitrary dependence on arbitrary length of pasts, that the hidden Markov model I described for it is, so it's called an epsilon machine, is this thing that's based on histories. That two-state epsilon machine describes that process, yep, that has an arbitrary dependence. Yeah. You can't always reduce to a finite state.
If you just take any old...
Well, it can't increase it.
...Markovian system, then your state space is going to grow.
Yeah, so...
It has to basically summarize everything about the past that's relevant.
Right, and so the key point being that you can take the list of pasts as a state, essentially.
Yeah.
And anything we're trying to summarize that can't increase the amount you've got to keep track of. It can only decrease it. It may not decrease it, but it can only decrease it. So that history's point of view leads directly to a state, and it's agnostic as to whether that state is anything real, but I think there's much closer connections between a history's point of view and a state-based point of view than is generally acknowledged, as, which I think is one of the benefits of looking at it through this hidden Markov model lens. If that addresses what you're saying.
It seems congruent with what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the notion of the state, as fun, the quantum state, what we call psi, that thing as being an element of reality or an element of our knowledge are both not exactly right.
Because they make a false presupposition, kind of?
Well, it assumes that ultimately the physics, I mean, now we have to talk about quantum gravity and so on, but it assumes that ultimately there will be such a well-defined object of psi in the theory. And I think if I had the full interpretation, I'd give it to you.
Sure, now. Right. Wouldn't we all? But,
you won't be talking about, there won't be any mathematical object that represents the state in when you describe the dynamics.
Right, so...
objects that represent history. That's my feeling.
Okay, so...
And it won't be a stochastic model.
Okay, so in that point of view, like, again, so you're saying it moves outside the ontological models framework.
Yeah.
But I think we would still describe that generally as a epistemic or doxastic interpretation, because...
But it's doxastic.
Meaning like belief-based rather than knowledge-based, which is a fuzzy barrier, but whatever. The point being that, sure, quantum states may not exist fundamentally, but we can always use them to do our math and to do our physics, right?
Up to a point.
Up to a point, exactly. So
theory probably won't allow them to get,
right, so
get the right answer.
Insofar as they partially get at that theory, that's where I think we would say they represent knowledge about that theory or belief about that actual theory. In a very loose way.
Why don't they represent facts about reality? That I don't understand.
Well, you're saying that there are no quantum states. They are not an element of reality, right?
But they're not an element. Yes, and that to that extent.
Okay, so that would mean that you're not a psi ontesist. Ontesist? Yeah, too many syllables. Yeah.
I guess so.
I was going to say also, yeah.
We're running out of time, but so let's thank Josh again and then continue.